this week in the markets. It was a good week for the precious metals and Bitcoin, but it was the Dow Jones average that closed at a new 135-year record. Well, welcome back, everyone. Your host with you again on this September 21st, Season 13, Episode 662 edition. We have another two big guest interviews. It was a big week for investors. They'll remember this one for quite some time, especially the precious metals, Bitcoin, and U.S. shares. More about that in a moment. And we'd like to remind everyone that Hurricane Florence has passed North Carolina and South Carolina, but the threat and the fallout remains. Many people have been displaced, including pets. Maybe you know a senior or someone who could use a friend. Rescued pets can be great for seniors. It brings camaraderie and friendship and helps save an innocent life. Plus, you can sign up with the Red Cross as a volunteer online. It's really easy to do. I did so this week. All you have to do is watch a couple of videos, fill out a few quick, easy forms, and they'll send you a link. So if you're inclined, it's really easy to do online. This week's two guests include a new guest, Dr. Raymond Moody, a renowned psychiatrist and author of the best-selling Life After Life. He actually coined the term near-death experience, an everyday term now. He's a co-founder of a new online university, and I actually sat in one of his courses 30 years ago as an undergraduate. We discussed his new groundbreaking research, as well as a seminar where he's outlining many of these findings in human logic in Montreal on October 20th. So let me encourage folks, if you're interested, to attend this seminar. And John Williams from ShadowStats returns to the show. He has dire comments on the domestic economy. He thinks investors have been lured into a false sense of complacency. And he might just be onto something, because this week the U.S. dollar collapsed from consolidation, where it really looked as though it was headed much, much higher. So this could be a sea change event for the precious metals investor. And we'd like for you to call in to our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900. You'll want the extension or mailbox number 514049. Please jot this down or plug it right into your mobile or home phone, 641-715-3900, mailbox number 514049. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear editorial. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Mostly sunny skies appeared over the precious metals sector this week amid lower tensions in the trade war between the U.S. and China. Gold held support at $1,201 at Friday's closing bell. The yellow metal was up just 20 cents, near break-even, but silver picked up a few dimes, closing at $1,414. But it was the XAU precious metals shares that added $2.67, 4% at $66. Black gold also added $1.80, up 2.5% at $70.78 per barrel, and the Bitcoin ETF, ticker GBTC, picked up 30 cents, 3.5%, finishing at 8.85, looking quite good in the technical position in the last 2 weeks. Well, the top story moving the precious metals sector, gold and especially silver and related shares, rebounded sharply amid extreme dollar weakness as investors anticipated the quarter point rate hike, as it's likely already baked into the market prices. The Federal Reserve will meet next week for its two-day FOMC meeting, slated for September 26th, where it's virtually a lock, 94% probability that we'll see an increase to 2.25% in the overnight lending rate, and then we'll probably see another rate hike to 2.5% in December, according to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange Group's Fed Funds Futures contracts. More importantly, officials are expected to give key guidance next week on future rate policy. I suspect that's likely a big component in this week's dollar sell-off. Elsewhere, Dr. Copper blasted higher by 8% this week. The semi-precious metal is used extensively in a wide array of industrial products, and in particular, of course, electronics. It's the backbone of the technology sector. From a financial standpoint, copper is often viewed as a key barometer of global economic output, so the strong move higher suggests improving economic conditions in the world's second largest economy, China. Media sources confirmed the increase in demand from the rousing Tiger Nation, as well as low stockpiles, making it solid conditions for improved commodities, especially with West Texas Intermediate crude looking so solid. Meanwhile, the U.S. administration announced on Monday it would impose a 10% tariff on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports, which could rise to 25% by year-end. China retorted Tuesday by announcing levies on over 5,000 American products worth $60 billion, effective next week. Now, the recent trade war with China continues to threaten economic conditions. However, China's Commerce Ministry did note on Thursday that these U.S. and Chinese tariffs were substantially lower than anticipated. We were really looking for about 25%, not just 10% hike, so that's at least viewed as a short-term compromise. Bottom line on precious metals. Well, you know, the U.S. dollar pullback gave us additional support this week, especially the XAU, which bounced right on cue from my last report's prediction. And silver, of course, seems to be following copper higher, all viewed as positives. Even Bitcoin added about $500 this week on the main contract. So we do have that holiday buying season. We have dollar sluggishness and a Fed that's looking more and more dovish. Let's hope for a better end to 2018 and early 2019. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange this week as U.S. equities continued higher within this astounding three-month winning streak ahead of next week's FOMC meeting. It was the 30-stock Dow Jones, though, that stole the show, adding nearly 600 points, 2%, at 26,743, a new all-time weekly high, a 135 record with key components McDonald's and Boeing outperforming. The S&P 500 also picked up 25, ending at 29.29, but the NASDAQ composite fell just 23 after having a remarkable rally to over 8,000 just a few weeks ago. Meanwhile, top shares in the news includes McDonald's, which rose about 3% after the company increased its quarterly dividend by 15% to $1.16 per share. And Biogen, ticker BIIB, looks solid. Its shares continue to outperform Zacks Biomedical and Genetic Industry Index. Other intriguing shares include Aflac, ticker AFL. It's a number two ranked Zack buy with strong earnings estimate consensus and a momentum score of B. Atlas Air Worldwide Holdings, that's ticker AAWW, also a Zack number two buy rating. Its shares have gained over 6% in 1 month. Advance Auto Parts, AAP, is a number one Zacks strong buy. It's gained about 6% over the last month as well. And for those interested in the cannabis revolution, the shares are now predicted by one of Zacks special reports to increase by threefold from approximately $6.5 billion to over $20 billion by 2021. We've had a big sell-off. Maybe it's time to start looking at some of the cannabis shares. Bottom line, U.S. shares. Well, right on cue, the U.S. market recorded new all-time records this week as forecasted in my last report. The Dow and S&P played catch-up, as I mentioned, to the NASDAQ, which topped 8,000 just a few weeks ago. And our USA Today 7 Indicator Greed to Fear Index pendulum remains slightly greedy, but there's still plenty of room for price growth. I can't really see anything on the horizon that will jeopardize this share advance, with, of course, the caveat, we do have an FOMC meeting next week. There's always something, right? Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Raymond Moody, the author of the best-selling book Life After Life, and also a former mentor of mine from 30 years ago. Welcome, Dr. Raymond Moody.
Thank you so much for letting me be here today, Chris. I'm really looking forward to this.
It's just a pleasure to have you with us. And, you know, the last time we spoke, I was, well, this is 30 years ago, I was about 19 years old in your class. So, you know, we had a very interesting discussion pre-show.
I tell you, Chris, 74 years old is just the most wonderful period of life. I am doing so well with elderlyhood. And as you may know, I have discovered near-death experience in reading Plato at the age of 18, and subsequently have interviewed thousands and thousands of people from all over the world who had profound experiences when they were revived after cardiac arrest or another close call with death, and wrote a book in 1974 when I was in medical school on the hundreds of cases that I had found since then. But subsequently, I was not born into a religious situation, thank God, being from Georgia. I mean, I'm just so glad I escaped all that. And my interest as a kid was astronomy. Went to the University of Virginia at age 18, intent on going on and getting my PhD in astronomy, but quickly got taken away into the realms of philosophy, and that's where I discovered near-death experiences. And but not having a religious background or any real acquaintance with this idea that there could be an afterlife, to me it's still very counterintuitive. I did not have any really religion per se, but I had friends who were Jewish, but that was the early 50s, and so I got a little bit of that, like but that's just about, like, not about life after death, but it's be kind to people and ask lots of questions, and so I got that sort, but in terms of a idea of an afterlife, zilch. And so just to tell you the truth, Chris, it's my specialty. To me, the fun of finding out something is to be very rigorous in your process so that if you think it through with exquisite logic, then you get to the point where you can be confident when you come up with something that that there is something to it. So to me, I just didn't rush right into thinking there's an afterlife. But just in the last few years, I've had to give up. And I'll tell you some specific things. I won an Italian surgeon who told me that in doing an elective operation on a fairly young man who was in overall good health with no expectation of a crisis, but nonetheless a cardiac arrest, and he couldn't revive the patient and was distressed, but then the door of the operating room swung open and a woman that he first thought was psychotic came screaming in and saying, it's like he realized she was saying, "My husband is not dead." She said, "I was out in the waiting room and my husband came to me and he said, 'You think he's dead?' So the doctor just immediately, without remembering, he just resumed the resuscitation, and after a while the man's heartbeat resumed and he was there when the patient regained consciousness, and the patient said, "Doc, I was up above my body there looking at you down there. I could tell you thought I was dead. I kept trying to say, 'I'm not dead, I'm not,' but you wouldn't hear me, so I went out into the waiting room and tried to tell my wife that I'm not dead." So there you go. I mean, I could give you a dozen more like that, but the point is, at a certain point, it's just I have to give up. And it's to me, as a non-religious person, when you say there is life after death, you might as well say, because if you really think it through as a logic problem, the whole sentence, "there is life after death," is just a self-contradiction, right? Because look up the words. What death just means is the final irreversible cessation of consciousness, right? So, or the final irreversible cessation of life. So we're not dealing with a clear-cut concept here. And that this is a famous objection to the whole deal by the great philosopher David Hume, for example, 1711 to 1776, one of the founders of what we would call today the scientific mind.
The Enlightenment.
Yes, and famously pointed out that the whole notion of an afterlife is logically incoherent. I mean, he said, by the mere light of reason, it seems difficult to prove the immortality of the soul. And that was just supposed to be an ironic comment, right? It's like, and he said, for some new species of logic is required for that purpose, and some new faculties of the mind that they may enable us to comprehend that logic. And he's absolutely right. And what he meant was, if we try to solve the afterlife problem with the mind we have and the logic we have, it's not going to work. But it seems impossible to do otherwise. But, Chris, I am making here and now the challenge to you as a man who is obviously intelligent and thought about these things, is that I am claiming to you right now that I have solved David Hume's great problem, and I can send you this manuscript and the whole deal, and would invite you to come to a seminar I'm giving in Montreal, free of charge. Of course, I can't pay your expenses, but on October 20th in Montreal, I'm giving a sort of one-day workshop on, it imparts these new logical principles. And I'll send you a manuscript ahead of time in case you see what might want to come. But I think there's a whole new way of working on this. And I think that we can actually now make a sort of breakthrough in the genuine rational investigation of the afterlife. Think about things that don't make sense. And this is nothing. Listen, the CIA has had me back 3 times on this. So that means, and these guys, thank God for these people, I tell you. I mean, this is just the nerd brigade. And, you know, it's nothing about, and I have never been with a nicer group of people. And I mean that completely sincerely. And, you know, the fact that, I mean, and a lot of people have been interested in this. So, you know, there is a whole new way now of thinking about this really big question of existence.
Now, wait a minute. You've piqued my interest here. The CIA?
I'm famous for the life after life thing, but what my work was, as I said in my book, Life After Life, at the very beginning, is that I studied logic and philosophy of language. See, and what I think I'm sort of an expert in, it was my doctoral dissertation, and I've just spent my whole life doing it, is that I have been able to figure out how you think logically about things that don't make sense. And some, and it's, there's a lot of big questions in science, for example, that rotate around this. Like, for example, we know that the two most powerful explanatory systems that have ever been devised are the general theory of relativity and the quantum theory. And the difficulty is
unification.
That's right. If you combine the two sets of equations, what you get is unintelligible nonsense, right?
Because you're dealing with the subatomic, and then you're dealing with the macro worlds, and then Einstein's field theories, in particular his field equations, which, I mean, just not to pat myself on the back, I've studied his equations, just don't fit at all with the...
And so what I'm getting at here is this more general, but it replies to the thing you're interested in specifically, is that what I've done is that I've worked out the logic of the unintelligible. All right, we know the logic you and I use is, you know, is a two-value code or a binary code, right? True or false,
right?
Or one or zero. But what I have is now I've added the third value, which is unintelligible. I've done this, and it's already been published in France, and it's, you know, but what I'm saying here is real. It sounds so counterintuitive. I can send you this manuscript, and you'll see for yourself. But now there's a whole new way that to think logically about some of the big issues. Now, I hope a lot of our listeners are interested.
I can think of one key area where your research should be quite applicable in quantum computing. Unlike our, as you mentioned, our binary everyday computing digital that we're used to, quantum computing has yes and no, and then an infinite probability of maybe.
Right, that's what this is. It's just there's a whole dimension of language that you hear, use, and see every single day, Chris, which because of a specific cognitive flaw, a kind of collective cognitive deficit, that people don't see a whole dimension of language. It's really fascinating. And that when you correct that and you bring this hidden layer of language to light to your conscious mind, then suddenly questions like the question of life after death, for example, a whole new light is shined on them. You see entirely new ways to think about it and investigate.
If we could put you on the spot with your body of research and decades of rumination on this topic, your gut intuition, exactly what happens after life?
So I am not describing my own thoughts about it to try to convince anybody else, but just in the interest of full disclosure for people who read my books, where I've come to is that I still almost stammer when I say this, that there is apparently, much to my surprise, and still very counterintuitively, that there is, I gather, something after this. And I mean, I've just never been so flabbergasted. You know, the fun of rational inquiry to me is to figure out the things that why it shouldn't be. You know, people who just already have some pre-existing belief and then put it out there and they try to construct some sort of argument, however flimsy, to support what they already think. I can't imagine that there would be any fun to that. When I come up with an idea, and then this is partly my training as a honors student in philosophy at UVA, is that my thought is to why are the reasons why this shouldn't be or is not? And that to me is just fun. I can't imagine the other perspective. So, you know, I have spent my life trying to think of the reasons why this is something else. Now, one thing it never much occurred to me that the something else could be is this idea that it's the chemical, the oxygen deprivation in the brain due to the cardiac arrest. And because one of my own professors in medical school was the first person to tell me about what I call a shared death experience, in which she had a, what we would call a near-death experience of leaving her body and seeing her mother's spirit and recede into this light. And she had it not when she was ill, but when she was resuscitating her own mother. So she was not having a, you know, the oxygen deprivation to her brain, but she empathically co-lived the near-death experience of her mother. I mean, I just hear this all the time. And, you know, so it's something else than that. But where I really have come to is I give up. It, see, what I am really most interested in as my single area of expertise is what makes things unintelligible. And we, our minds are totally wiped out about that. Because, and it's too bad because people love Dr. Seuss and Lewis Carroll and doo-wop music, sha-na-na-na-na-na, sha-na-na, and nursery rhymes and scat singing with Louis Armstrong, all these things, but they hate the word nonsense. And that creates that, because these patterns of language that Edward Lear and Shel Silverstein and Dr. Seuss use to amuse kids, are the same kind of language pattern as I observed in medical school and residency and practice that people fall into in various kinds of mental disorders. And these same kinds of patterns exactly. So there's nonsense is nonsense.
You wouldn't be speaking about Tourette's syndrome, obviously, because that's mostly cursing, but you're talking about random, unintelligible, garbled speak from...
like schizophrenic psychosis.
Korsakoff psychosis, perhaps?
Yes, yes. When they have some sort of amazing inner experience that they can't find difficult to put into ordinary words, is that they tend to talk nonsense about it. For example, there's a neurological condition called synesthesia.
Oh, yes, yes, feeling colors and smelling sounds.
Yes, or where somebody hears sounds, but the sounds to them bring up colors in their minds. And so, or it, all the senses, like, or a chef, a famous chef, who, when he tasted shapes, and he would say things like, this chicken tastes too round.
You know, autistics, folks with Asperger's syndrome, oftentimes refer to numbers as friends. So 71 is a bad number. 7 is a prime number. It's a good green number. So synesthesia, very common in autistics, yes.
Yeah, and well, here I am. Asperger's is me. I mean, I finally just can't tie my shoes. I can't tie a tie. You know, I tell you. And it's a delightful thing. They say that Jefferson had it for sure now.
Einstein had it, almost certainly. Alan Turing had it. Ramanujan, of course, the great mathematician. So many folks, sharp minds, creative types, too.
I wanted to be an astronomer and a So part of my Asperger's seems to be the weird sense of humor. From my instinct is that, yeah, there is a life after death. People say things like, oh, you know, it's just wishful thinking, but that's baloney because I never even thought to think about whether I wanted there to be an afterlife. But when I finally reached this point, I give up when my own medical doctor friends, who I would go to in a minute if I had some medical condition, heaven forbid, and that I would go to them for their specialty, and yet they tell me that due to their own near-death experiences, they say, yeah, this is real, and they talk about the same environment, obviously. And then the case I mentioned of the surgeon who, and another case that is coming out very soon of a trauma surgeon to talk to his patient's deceased wife in the operating room while he was operating.
Here's one for you. The neurosurgeon, who I believe had, I want to say, some type of meningitis, found himself in a coma.
Yes. Oh, yes. Abbott, my good friend, too. Yeah.
He regales his audience with this astounding, you know, 6 or 7 day in detail life experience during his coma.
Yeah. And, you know, I talked to some people who knew Abbott before and better than ever. They say, you know, it wasn't that it normally this would. You know, just people would never be the same. But everybody who knew Eben before that, they say, yeah, he's a different person. He came back just better. I'm just looking forward to the first little bit myself. But I wouldn't be surprised at anything. I'll tell you the truth. I wouldn't.
But I'm sure you've heard discussions from folks who have been there and back. Has that given you a model that you can share with us today that seems like the most likely outcome?
Yeah, what I acknowledge that the collective description, as it were, if you sort of summarize all the cases, what it tends to be is that people say that you have the feeling of leaving your body, that you withdraw from your body, and you see yourself down below as a physical body, but you quickly lose interest in that body. And that you enter into a state of consciousness where, and no matter how articulate you are, that you just have no words to describe. And they say it's like you go through a passageway into a realm of sheer light that you could also call love, and that in that light there is sort of reunions with the spirits of your deceased relatives and friends, and then a panoramic review in which you relive every incident of your life from the point of view of others with whom you've interacted, and that you come back from this transformed thinking that the purpose of the life we're in is to learn to love and to sort of go through some sort of progress. Yeah, so that's the scenario that I hear from people all over the world, thousands and thousands of people. I'll talk with you again soon, too, and thanks so much for the listeners, too. I hope they had a good time with us today. We're hoping to get our word about our University of Heaven out. Looking forward to talking with you again. Bye-bye.
It It's a pleasure to welcome back alternative economist John Williams to the show. He's helped investors for decades keep ahead of the trends in the markets with his alternative economic projections. Welcome back, John Williams.
Thank you.
Can we understand you're recovering and hopefully feeling a bit better today?
I am, yes. Thank you.
Very good. Obviously, for the last 10 years or so, Fed officials have attempted to extricate us from the Great Recession of 2008. To do so, they've printed at least $14 trillion, according to their numbers. That's required up to $100 billion worth of QE per month for many years. All of that is coming to an end, according to their latest projections, and probably by the end of this year, early 2019, after the ninth rate hike, will probably come close to wrapping up their rate hike cycle. And I'd like to know whether or not you think that might just change the overall theme in the financial market.
I've never found financial markets, particularly the stock market, to be particularly rational in unusual times such as we've had here. I don't think they're going to get to where they think they're going to go in raising rates. Two things. One, the banking collapse, or near banking collapse that we saw back in 2008, is a circumstance that has dominated Fed activity. They've been concentrating on keeping the banks afloat. They've done very little to help support the economy or to stimulate actual growth in the economy. And as a result of that, what you've seen is, yes, you've got your banks afloat, but they're not functioning normally. You're not seeing normal lending, full economic recovery. There's some areas that that have. It's a very dangerous situation to the extent that you have. I'll contend there actually is now something of a nascent recovery in the aggregate economy. We're off bottom. We have not recovered to where we were back in 2007. But it's useful to look at the way the elements of the business cycle are defined here. Traditionally, over time, it was fairly straightforward and simple. Economy grows, you hit peak activity, and that's called the peak. Then the economy starts to move off its peak. It slows down. It's recessing. That's what's called the recession. Until the economy hits bottom, that's the trough, and then it starts to rise again, which is referred to as recovery. But it's not an expansion until it recovers its pre-recession high. If you look at the GDP, which is the most heavily massaged and gimmicked of the government's numbers, you're saying that the economy has recovered order of magnitude 17.5%. It's over 20% above the trough in the downturn. But there's no other number that's showing anything close to that, and you should be seeing that all over the place if that's what the economy's doing. Even the employment numbers go from trough to peak. You may be seeing 3, 4, maybe 6% recovery, but you're not seeing 17%. Retail sales is up about, real retail sales is up about 8% recovery, and that's deflated by the CPI. And as I know we've talked before, the headline inflation numbers out of the government tend to be understated, and when you use something like an understated inflation number to deflate your economic activity, that tends to overstate the growth. And then you have sectors of the economy, such as manufacturing, that never recovered its pre-recession high. You're still down 5% from the pre-recession peak back in 2007. Or the housing industry. Housing starts are down basically 50% from where they were at their pre-recession high. So you're not seeing a normal economic recovery. And then you look at the consumer. Consumer's income generally is not growing. You look at the headline real earnings out of the Bureau of Labor Statistics right now, you're seeing flat growth year to year. Consumer credit, which is where, your income's not growing, you need to increase your spending. Oftentimes you can do that through expanding debt, but consumer credit outstanding adjusted for inflation is not recovered. You're not seeing a normal economy here, and without normal recovery in the consumer income, without normal recovery in growth and credit, which is a banking function, that's why one reason I say the banking system's not functioning right, you have a very strange economic circumstance that is far from advertised. And what the Fed's doing now in raising interest rates is beginning to kill consumers again, or intensify their their liquidity squeeze. As that intensifies, you're going to see, in fact, we're already seeing, renewed weakness in the headline economic numbers. Last week or so, we've had a reporting for retail sales and industrial production, two of the big series. And if you look at the net of inflation, these are the government's numbers, the government's inflation numbers. What you'll see is that retail sales in the last month or two has been virtually flat, adjusted for inflation and background revisions. And the industrial production, which just showed reasonably strong growth, it was only strong because activity in the prior periods was revised lower. If you take out what they did in restating prior history to the downside, you really didn't have any gain in the month. It's not a healthy circumstance. And with the Fed continuing to raise rates, tighten liquidity, you were seeing the money supply drop off. And when that drops off, and especially when you look at it net of the headline inflation, it gets to a certain level, that normally signals a recession. So if we're headed into a recession here, what the Fed allows for, and what's the primary functioning of the Fed is it expresses itself, or at least looking at it as it behaves, is to keep the banking system afloat. The reason they went into quantitative easing was to salvage the banking system, that the downturn created liquidity stresses on the banks. If we're heading into a deepening downturn here, you're going to see those stresses mount again. The Fed's going to move towards back towards quantitative easing. They're going to back off their tightening. And with that, you're going to see a reaction in the markets that will hit the dollar hard, drive investors to gold and silver as they look at the increased risks of dollar debasement and inflation.
I'd like to talk about the potential here for a coordinated contraction by global central bankers. If we look at Michael Pinto's work at Pinto Economics, he's noting at least 14 of the Fed's colleagues around the world have plans to curtail their QE operations, even wrap them up entirely, by the end of 2018. So in just the next three or so months, we could see that. Just how such a coordinated contraction or hawkishness around the globe would not have some type of negative impact on the financial markets?
I think it would. In fact, I doubt you're going to see it. I don't think the Fed's going to be able to continue what they're doing, and if they can't continue what they're doing, the rest of the world's not going to become virginal again.
We might see maybe a flattening or even inversion of the yield curve before any of that can really happen. Is that a potential scenario?
The Fed is so heavily controlling the credit markets. I mean, they still have trillions in treasuries that they're holding that they're looking to liquidate, and there's no normal market here in the credit markets. If there were, you'd be seeing very different circumstances. Consider, for example, I mean, the concept behind interest, getting interest on money you lend, is to get a return that beats inflation. And even given the phony low numbers that you get out of the government on inflation, most of the Treasury securities give you a negative real return. Why would you invest your money in something where you're not going to stay ahead of it from an inflation standpoint? You do better to go out and buy a box of canned goods and hold it for a year, and you'll have made some money. It's just not a stable, normal circumstance. It doesn't have a happy ending. If back in 2008 they'd let the banking system fail and declared a banking holiday and reorganized the system, people who owned the banks would have had some very severe losses, and it certainly would have disrupted the system for a bit. But I think they would have kept the investors, the depositors' cash intact. They would have had a new system, and you could have gone forward and rebuilt a strong economy. Instead, what's happened here is that we've had 10 years where the Fed's been concentrating and trying to get the banking system back to normal functioning and solvency at the expense of normal economic stimulus and activity. As I'm looking at things here, you're going to see this supposed recovery. I mean, it's not, again, we are off bottom, but you're not seeing the type of boom that's being headlined. as the basic consumer starts falling off the cliff again, we're at the brink of seeing retail sales turning lower in real terms. Same thing with industrial production. It's going to put the system under increased financial stress. The banks are going to be under stress, and the Fed's got to come back in and start reversing the quantitative easing.
Obviously, we are facing some bubbles here. I mean, if we look at the S&P index, break it down by major city into the individual components, we haven't seen this type of bubble since 2005, 2006. I mean, it really does look as though the echo bubble in housing has been a critical component of this, at least on paper. Then what will happen if and when the Case-Shiller indexes start to unwind and turn around? Because we can't obviously grow at this pace forever.
It's a measure of wealth. The thing is that you have home prices have gone higher, and indeed real estate by its nature is a hard asset, like gold and silver, just not portable or liquid. That's actually a positive sign. But if you look at actual activity, home sales, existing home sales never recovered. They're now down year to year. They've been down straight 5 months, month after month after month. Those are existing home sales. That's the existing real estate market. The housing starts, the construction, you're down 50% from where you were before. You've seen higher home prices, and that's good, and that helps with their assets and wealth and ability, hopefully, to borrow money if they need to borrow money. It's still very difficult for people to get mortgages. It's still not a stable circumstance to have that area really stabilize. I mean, those are people, where people own a house, that's a real asset. But you're not seeing the demand for homes or new construction that you'd normally expect in a growing economy, let alone one that is supposedly fully recovered and expanding. It's showing that you're, I mean, depending, I don't care what measure you look at. You look at total construction spending, that's in dollars. It includes everything from roads to bridges and houses, government buildings, in dollar value.
Much of this housing echo bubble is the result of inflationary monetary policies, quantitative easing methods to purchase up toxic mortgage-backed securities and related stimulus.
It could be. I mean, I know the housing prices have risen, and it's a hard asset like gold and silver. It doesn't get manipulated as much as gold and silver, but it's not a bad place to have your money. Again, it's just from looking at it from an investment standpoint in terms of liquidity. There may be periods of time where things get difficult, and you may not be able to sell it as rapidly as you want. But people look to live in their homes, and that's their primary function. But they're also solid. That's where the word real comes from in the real estate. It's a real asset. Aside from the precious metals, it's a good place to have your money.
Economists have a term called the housing paradox. Regardless of the fact that you may on paper have made, let's say, $100,000 or $200,000 on the price appreciation of the underlying asset, you still, once selling the home, most people find themselves in the quandary of having to procure a new home, a new residence. Has your wealth really increased so much after taxes, after capital gains, after expenses? So moving on then, let's talk about the precious metals. Do you buy the thesis that we probably bottomed out in the late 2015 and might be building a base for a continuation of the bull rally in the yellow metal?
Let me put it this way. I don't see any long-term investment vehicle other than physically holding gold and silver as a viable option going into the future. The problem that we have here is that the U.S. government is bankrupt long-term. There's no question. Unless we can somehow get our fiscal conditions under control, convince the world that long-range, the U.S. Treasury is solvent, the purchasing power of the dollar is doomed. And what will save you there is the physical gold and silver, the precious metals. They do all sorts of funny things over time, but over time, hold the gold and silver. You look at it for the long haul, and over the long haul, that's going to save your neck. You know, I work alternate measures of inflation, where the headline on CPI right now is running a little under 3%. I'm looking at something closer to 10%, and people think maybe my number's high. I'm not going to argue with that. It's certainly the reality is certainly a lot higher than what you see out of the government's numbers. But the interesting thing I find is that if you look at the headline inflation out of the government and my estimates and gold, if you go back to 1900, you look at the history of gold prices in the United States and the colonies. Back in 1900, before the Fed was founded, the price of gold and the rate of inflation were reasonably constant over time. You had ups and downs with the gold rush in California and the inflation around the various wars. But if you look at it over 300 years, back into the late 1600s, you're looking at pretty much a flat line against what you have today. You see, start to see a little bit of pickup in inflation, and also you have different areas where gold gets traded, but against where it's fixed in those days. But you come to Roosevelt and his abandoning the domestic gold standard. All of a sudden, you start to see a spike in inflation, depending upon the measures you look at gold. And then you come to the Nixon era, where he abandons the convertibility of the dollar for gold on an international basis. We're just off to the races with inflation. Plotted over time, and you've seen these big surges in gold in the last decade or so, and you'll see that that tends to run a lot above the headline inflation. But if you look at my estimates and what the headline inflation would be if you didn't have all the changes that the government had made to the calculation of the CPI, and those changes are usually designed to understate inflation, and that's for purposes of helping to keep the budget deficit down, like cutting on COLA adjustments and such. If you take my number over time, it pretty much tracks gold. Inflation against gold, or gold against inflation, I think I can show that gold pretty much is indeed as advertised your real money. It maintains its value in terms of what common experience is with inflation.
I think that's where many of the commentators, analysts in this area might miss the point, because they're using government inflation statistics to track the price of gold, and so the correlation is not readily apparent. But if you actually take a look at the money supply, I think, which is maybe your point here today, if I'm not missing it, that is a better gauge of ultimate price inflation, or at least true inflation.
And indeed, which brings me to the literally million or billion or God knows trillion or zillion as I get into the hyperinflation question. You have now a circumstance where the U.S. government has issued bonds that total something over $20 trillion. Those are bonds that they've got to pay. They have, and that's against a total headline U.S. economy, which is, in nominal terms, before an inflation adjustment, about $20 trillion. To raise the money to pay off that $20 trillion right up front is difficult. Something's got to be worked out over time. The problem is that we're still adding to the debt, and if you look at the government's accounting, you have circumstances here where, for example, you have programs such as Social Security and Medicare, and there are obligations on that going forward in time that the government is committed to without the income flows on it. Those are pay-as-you-go programs. And what happens there is that the accountants who put together the government's financial statements not only put together the current assets and liabilities, but they also put together the net present value of future obligations. What that means is if you take the future value of money, what would you need in hand today to cover your obligations? Now, if you have a long-term surplus, that's not an issue. If you have a long-term deficit, that's where you start to have to worry. And where we owe maybe $20 trillion in today's money, based on those existing bonds and notes, there's $100 trillion that we owe when you look at it in terms of the net present value. And that's not what we have to pay out in the future, it's what we need in hand today to cover what's due in net obligations in the future. We need $100 trillion today to be solvent down the road. We don't have it. We have no way of raising it, which means the government has to reorganize its long-term financial structure, its programs. If it doesn't, eventually you end up with a hyperinflation. It is inevitable.
Let's address some actual real-world tangible hyperinflations already underway. I mean, obviously, if we take a look at the Venezuelan Bolivar, one U.S. dollar, by November of 2016, it had fallen off the cliff. By December, we had literally seen hyperinflation underway. And then, of course, we all know now today, 1,000,000% inflation is at least the headline number they've been tossing around. These things can happen quickly. Turkey, currency crisis there as well. And these are just a few examples. At what point do you think the world just, gives up on our ability to maintain hegemony as the reserve currency?
Well, I think when it'll come faster than people expect, and you're going to have a tremendous crisis. It'll blow apart the system as we know it. And this is part of what I'm talking about here is in terms of trying to get things stable in the, if we can come up with a way of having things that you can say, look, here's how we've restructured things. We're stable long term. We don't have to worry about the long term solvency of the government. That would have all sorts of positive things. There's some pain there as you restructure, but you have to restructure. If you go back to when S&P downgraded the treasuries about a decade ago, Alan Greenspan, who was no longer Fed chairman at the time, made a comment that to the effect that there's no way the U.S. is ever going to default on its debt because its debt is owed in dollars and we can print as many dollars as we want. And he's absolutely right. There's, there are things where you can create an event of default. Creating hyperinflation is not one of them. That does not count as it should be an event of default. The point is that if you can always print the money you need to meet your obligations, you end up with a hyperinflation. That's the common thread that you see here. Look at Zimbabwe. Printed the money they needed. And that was probably the greatest numerical hyperinflation anyone's ever seen. We're doing that now. We've got it under the cover of all sorts of things, but we have in hand right now a circumstance where it's demonstrable that we do not have the ability to cover our obligations going forward. And as Greenspan pointed out, we can print it whatever dollars we need. That's the way Washington's looking at it, contend that they are. There's virtually no hope for the dollar. Someone's got to address the circumstance and try and get it under control. Address the American people, say, look, we all know we've got a problem here with our long-term solvency. We don't get it resolved now. We're going to face an ultimate crisis in a couple of years, whatever. This is needed to have a stable environment for our children and grandchildren going forward. Bite the bullet, reorganize the system, hopefully go forward on a positive basis. The issue comes, when does the global market give up on the dollar? The rate that we're now increasing our budget deficit, our deficit spending, it's going to trigger something more likely than not in the near future. And what you're going to see, suddenly you're seeing a big flight from the dollar. Foreign investors are pulling away. They don't think we're going to resolve our banking system crisis. What the Fed's doing now is not working, something like that. And once you see the world start to turn on the dollar, you have others in the background who be very happy to try and throw some gasoline on the smoldering fire, who have other interests in terms of getting greater control of the global markets, the currency markets, such as China. You start to get a panic. It can become self-feeding, and where you might say, oh, we've got 10, 20 years before we're really going to have a crisis here. All of a sudden, you're going to have the crisis in hand. If people don't want to hold the dollars, you're going to end up with a hyperinflation, and it can hit quickly. Little warning. There should be some warning. You'll see signs of it, but it's that's why I generally advocate that people look to hold some physical gold and silver as an insurance policy. It's a store of wealth. It preserves whatever is invested into it long term in terms of its purchasing power, and it'll help you ride through what are likely going to be difficult times. I thought this was going to break some time ago, as you know. It hasn't, but the circumstances have only gotten worse.
turned to South America. Officials there in Venezuela have actually issued a gold-backed note in order to try to stabilize their currency. But unfortunately, by now, most of the public have been so eviscerated by a tsunami of inflation, as you said, just erupted overnight, seemingly. How many people actually have any value to purchase gold-backed notes to help stabilize the economy? And I think that's also something we might be facing here domestically, because on the one hand, while our officials say times have never been better and happy days are here again, blue skies, but will the bulk of folks be able to find, you know, this insurance policy or buy this insurance policy we refer to as gold?
It's a good question. You do the best you can. You need to be prudent the way you handle things. You need to try and get some stuff, as difficult as it may be. Because anything that you have, plus there, will be magnified many times over when the crisis hits. And there are other things you can look at, too. Again, if you have a hyperinflation, or when you have one, you're going to have problems with the normal functioning of the economy. And other things will take on value, such as canned goods. Some stock of items such as that you can use for barter, you're going to be in a lot better shape than someone who doesn't have stuff like that to barter.
In this world we live today, I mean, the idea has been more of a monopoly game style, hop from the hottest paper asset to the next. And, you know, most of our populace today have little more than 3, maybe 5 days worth of household provisions in the cupboards, you know, in the event of an emergency. I think the idea that canned goods, anything like that, whether it be backup power sources, solar generators, or even financial insurance for your household, is a difficult one for people.
Unless you think the government can straighten out its long-term finances and sell the people in the global markets on it. I wish they could. I don't think there's a chance of that.
Well, that's what financial history shows us. They will try every possible machination at their disposal to try to pull the economy out of the quagmire, but it's inevitable that you have to service the debt. The debt has to be, eventually, it has to either be written off. Would you then expect that FEME and higher U.S. equities prices might be in jeopardy? Do you have any concerns then about U.S. treasuries, since we're looking for a flattening and perhaps even inversion of the yield curve? What advice can you give investors?
Well, buying the treasuries is real solid and safe as the dollar, and the dollar's not safe. I'd avoid them.
Even the short yield?
If you can't make enough of a return on it that you're at least covering headline inflation, not my inflation number, you're losing money. You'd better to, if you've got $10,000 you want to put in treasury bills, put it into gold. You're going to find the price is going to fluctuate, but you look at that 2 years from now, I'd say you're certainly going to be up against inflation with the gold. Likely you're not going to be with the treasuries. You could get yields that actually were higher than the inflation being experienced at the time, so that was a good investment. You don't have it now. The reason for the treasuries is safety, and all you're going to get back from the government is dollars. And if they're looking to depreciate the dollar through tremendous deficit spending and debasing the dollar, you're not getting real purchasing power. So it's not a good deal.
There's also Treasury inflation-protected securities, or TIPS as they refer to it, and there's even an ETF to participate. It's based on the government inflation numbers, I mean, obviously.
Let's say you own TIPS and you went into a hyperinflation. And let's say they could adjust the interest rate daily so that it reflected the inflation of the day. You get into hyperinflation, like you saw in Zimbabwe or the Weimar Republic. The changes are so rapidly. If you sold your bond and waited a day to get the check from the government, what might have been worth something the day before would be worth nothing the next day.
Yeah, but what about listeners who are scratching their heads thinking that is historically accurate, but following much of these hyperinflations typically involve the loss of a major geopolitical event, such as, let's say, the loss of World War I. And we had a similar situation here with the American Civil War, where hyperinflation broke out primarily in the South, but also arguably in the North as well. But, you know, we are still technically the world's global superpower.
Yeah, we are the superpower. Our currency increasingly is not going to be. And that's the thing is, we're doing everything we can now to debase the dollar. Where you have the rest of the world putting its money with the dollar, as long as you have the rest of the world still investing in the United States, and the dollar's value is reasonably stable in the currency markets, you're not to that threshold of the hyperinflation. But when the rest of the world turns against the dollar and they don't want to hold it, and they start dumping the treasuries, as the purportedly the Chinese are beginning to do, and the Russians have done some of, you're going to end up with a circumstance where the only one buying the treasuries is going to be the Federal Reserve again. If they put that out into the system, which you're going to have to do, you will get your hyperinflation. Part of it's a confidence in the currency.
Wouldn't you agree that he who has the biggest army controls the petroleum? That's a key component to the solvency of your currency, the reserve currency. And we still have that.
In principle, what you say is fine. There is a presumption there as well that you're living reasonably within your means, or you're able to support yourself through exports or whatever. We're losing that. We're at the brink of the worst ever trade deficit end of last year. Now, yeah, our petroleum is picking up, and that's a plus. I mean, that's one area of the economy, real positive activity. But against the rest of the world, we also have basically the world's greatest trade deficit. That long-term debases your currency. Again, it's a matter of something triggering a flight from the currency. And you'll see that in the dollar. I would look at the dollar in the exchange markets. You start to see the dollar plummeting sharply. That's going to be an early forerunner of hyperinflation. And that we've had bouts of that, and it's reversed, and all sorts of things that get tied to that.
Since there is that interrelatedness, do you then see inevitably the entire currency system freezing up, somewhat similar to 2008?
It could. The thing is, let me put it this way. What we've been talking about here, we've otherwise been seeing in slow motion. It's just a matter of acceleration. You go back to 1900, and that's back when the currency system was still based on gold. If you had $100, if you'd had that $100 back in 1800, you'd basically still have that $100 in 1900. But if you had that $100 in 1900, when you look at that today, and you just held the $100, your $100 would have purchasing power today of about 14 cents. That's effectively a hyperinflation, only that's over 120 years, effectively. That's the type of thing you're going to see initially over the period of 6 months, a year, and then it gets worse. It's just a matter of accelerating the process. And what started that was our basically creating money out of thin air. Before that, it had been anchored to gold. If you debase the currency, just print it up on Greenspan. Yeah, don't worry about our defaulting. We can always print the dollars that we owe.
If we were to go back and look at the Weimar, or even, you know, post-World War II, Europe, ashes and embers of a former great civilization, that led to the Bretton Woods Agreement. There were areas of stability outside of Europe, outside that arena, that were relatively unfazed by the carnage. Today, it sounds as though there will be virtually no safe harbor for at least the bulk of investors. Once this is unleashed, that's where things could unravel very quickly. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes. And the thing is, there is protection against it. Again, the precious metals over time have had the store of wealth effect viewed as money. That's over millennia. If you have your cash in gold, so to speak, and sit by whatever happens, and I can't tell you all how things are going to break or who's going to do what, but over time, the precious metals will retain that same basic value. It gets you through a very difficult time, and as things restabilize, as systems get rebuilt, and that happens, you still have those same assets that you had before that you can then put to work in a new system.
As we wrap up today, I think the only other question would be the safety of your stockpile, if you will, or of the little bit of whatever resources you've been able to crystallize into gold and silver and related assets. So do you like global diversification? Do you like the thought of storing with Brinks and other opportunities outside of one's particular nation?
Well, that's never a bad idea to diversify. I'd like personally, I'd look to keep direct control of it myself. With something like gold, you're talking something that's of high enough value in terms of its physical volume that you probably would do well to keep some of that in-house or wherever. You don't want to tell people where it is. If the system blows apart, you may not be able to rely upon other people who may be holding it for you.
I mean, they are concentrated wealth, but not always safe for crossing borders. Would you then advise investors to at least stay somewhat apprised, not necessarily invested, but apprised of the cryptocurrency situation, so that if times really get bad, they might be able to leave the country and then buy gold and silver in their new nation?
Well, I'm not going to speculate as to how well the cryptocurrencies are going to survive this circumstance. It certainly might be an alternative approach that you might want to use as a partial backup. But frankly, I just look at physical gold and silver, and people are generally pretty creative in the ways they can handle that.
And as we close today, if you could tell people more about ShadowStats.com.
Well, I put out an electronic newsletter one a week, and at least, and it's available by subscription, shadowstats.com. You can look at our website. We've got all sorts of background information. Look at some of the old hyperinflation reports, headlines, basically what's happening, and how you can look to protect yourself there. And we're always happy to get new subscribers. Costs $175 a year, $89 for 6 months. Always happy to have new subscribers. But again, you look at the available papers and articles on the site, I think you'll find a lot of interest.
All right, John Williams, very thought-provoking, a bit alarming, but I'm sure that it'll serve us all well when it comes to, the real economic numbers.
I can tell you that over time, the gold will always retain its value and you can sell it. Nothing else happens. Again, thank you for having me, Chris.
Thanks so much.
Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. There is a page on the Social Security website entitled Trust Fund Frequently Asked Questions. I highly recommend reading this page firsthand. For brevity, I'll share a few questions for the purpose of this discussion. The first question: what are the Social Security Trust Funds? The Social Security Trust Funds are the Old Age and Survivors Insurance and the Disability Insurance Trust Funds. The next question: what happens to the taxes that go into the trust funds? Tax income is deposited on a daily basis and is invested in special issue securities. The cash exchanged for the securities goes into the general fund of the Treasury and is indistinguishable from other cash in the general fund. The next question: if all the income is invested, how do benefits get paid each month? Money to cover expenditures, mainly benefit payments from the trust funds, come from the redemption or sale of securities held by the trust funds. When special issue securities are redeemed, interest is paid. In fact, the principal amount of special issues redeemed plus the corresponding interest is just enough to cover an expenditure. The next question: what were the amounts of securities bought and sold in recent years? The amount bought in 2017 was $2,000 billion, while the amount sold was $1,156 billion. See investment transactions for more detail and earlier years. Before I share the last question, a side note comment. If you stop and think about those previous numbers, that's $2 trillion of inputs. and roughly $1.15 trillion in Social Security expenditures, leaving $850 billion that was added to the general fund and spent elsewhere. The final question I'll share is, why do some people describe these special issue securities held by the trust funds as worthless IOUs? What is Social Security's reaction to this criticism? Money flowing into the trust funds is invested in U.S. government securities. Because the government spends this borrowed cash, some people see the trust fund assets as an accumulation of securities that the government will be unable to make good on in the future. Without legislation to restore long-range solvency of the trust funds, redemption of long-term securities prior to maturity would be necessary. Far from being worthless IOUs, the investments held by the trust funds are backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government. The government has always repaid Social Security with interest. The special issue securities are, therefore, just as safe as U.S. savings bonds or other financial instruments of the federal government. There's more to digest, including discussions of future trust fund solvency. But the question you must answer is, do these representations make you more confident or less confident in the financial future of the country? At the end of the day, the government's only capital asset is you. And the solution in practice means more taxes, a reduced standard of living, or both. Debt-based Ponzi schemes never end well. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.